Welcome to Contextual Electronics. My name is Chris Gamble, and this is the third podcast for the Contextual Electronics podcast. Today is going to be a little bit different than the past two. In the past two, we talked to Sophie Wong, who is an artist and maker, and then we talked to Stephen Hawes, who is doing a DIY pick and place, also kind of building stuff up from the ground up, and both are kind of integrating mechanical and software and hardware, and that is a lot of the things that we're going to be doing in Contextual Electronics podcast is talking to people that are outside the sphere of electronics, not necessarily, you know, 30-year experts in just one area of electronics like I do over on the Amp Hour, but more well-rounded and people doing things kind of all over the place but using electronics in their work. Today is going to be a little different in that I am talking to an expert, and this is because This is a coworker of mine, a former coworker at a job, and then a fellow consultant who I've worked with since, Eric Larson. And that's Eric Larson, the firmware engineer, not Eric Larson, the author. And we have worked together on interesting projects. Eric's specialty is firmware, and I usually am doing hardware, and that's the case with all the projects we've done together. I've been doing more firmware lately, and Eric has been a great reference for this. Eric is also a really wonderful reviewer of my work, and so today's episode is about using a coworker or using a friend or anyone else to go and review your work before you put it out into the world. And this is actually because today he's going to help me be reviewing the Advanced Bluetooth Cellular Project, which is the latest project course from Contextual Electronics. We are designing a small Raspberry Pi hat with a center part that breaks out. And then the center part has a cellular modem, it's got a Bluetooth chip, and a microcontroller. So it can do low power, it can do cellular, it can do Bluetooth, it can do all the other modes that the NRF52840 can do. And then it also has battery charging and all the interface necessary to then squish it together as a sandwich with another board that can be custom designed to have any function on it. And so the idea is basically making a development platform that can be used over and over and over again to design electronics that have Bluetooth and cellular integrated in them in a relatively small package, about 35 by 40 millimeters. Anyways, this is all to say that we're going to be going over some schematic stuff today, so that's a little bit different. I thought it was kind of interesting, and this is why I'm excited about video. Now, of course, if you're just listening here, it's going to be a little bit harder to follow along because there will be some referencing to some of the stuff that's on the screen. There will actually be a schematic on the screen. We're going to try our best to explain things, but if necessary, I would recommend, if you're listening to this, to go and check out the video version at some point as well to get a better clue of kind of what we're looking at here. So here is the episode with Eric Larson, the third podcast in the first release of the Contextual Electronics podcast. We're doing that because if you are so inclined, after three episodes, we wanted to have you to have a full view of all three episodes. We are hoping that people are willing to go and give iTunes reviews or tell their friends about it right up front, because that really helps to spread the word and make this a bigger thing and get the word out about the Contextual Electronics podcast. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Eric Larson, firmware engineer extraordinaire and a friend of mine from work in the past. How do we know each other?
Wow. I guess we met at Hologram, mm-hmm. a little startup in Chicago there that does cellular connectivity. Mm-hmm. So I'd been one of the first, let's see, I was probably the fifth, I think, employee there. I'd really originally started there as a contractor. They were trying to do a Kickstarter with some hardware, and they had one guy who was doing like all the hardware and software design for this dev board they were calling the Dash, and he was a little overwhelmed with doing all of that because it was pretty ambitious.
Right.
Like, yes.
Yeah, the Dash.
Two microcontrollers.
Cool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And one was like based off the Teensy too, and that's like not a small micro. And
yeah, it was kind of the idea. I think the original idea was a Teensy with a modem on it, and then it kind of grew to be like, well, let's make this like a all things to all people kind of a dev platform. Mm. And of course, so complexity
as hardware as wants to do, you know, like
yes. Yeah. And and then you know, it's then after when you have the hardware, it's just software. So yeah, no problem. Just write that software.
Right, so right.
That's the stage they were at, yeah.
Right. Well, and when I came in, I met you, obviously, when I started there much later. And I would come to you. I was doing, like, developer relations stuff and trying to get people to use the Dash and other hardware that was there. But one of the interesting tasks was you basically had to take the Dash then and then make it also Arduino compatible, because you're trying to bring people in that are beginners and or, you know, people that are just trying to stand something up quickly. And that's got its own set of challenges of just playing into that ecosystem then.
Yeah, had I known that that was kind of the original intent, we probably would have made some different hardware design choices, because mm-hmm. the microcontrollers that we picked did not have Arduino ports even really attempted. Teensy was probably the closest, but it was the microcontroller they chose Freescale didn't even have all of the drivers for that version of it. It was kind of a one-off because it had extra flash, and so I ended up having to write all kinds of drivers just for the chip itself, and then all the Arduino compatibility. I had to port all those drivers to make it match up to what the Arduino APIs looked like at a low level.
Yeah, and so a lot of people that are listening or watching this are probably, you know, maybe closer to the beginning of their journey, and so they probably are familiar with an Arduino, right? And it just kind of feels like this thing, like, hey, analog input or digital output, or, you know, you have these set functions and it does a thing. But I remember the first time I started looking at, like, what's underneath, and it's like, oh wow, there's a lot of, you know, each micro that's supported, it's got its own set of stuff underneath there. Like, there's whole blocks of code that are kind of taking this genericized IDE, like the Arduino style code, that then every variation that is compatible with it has to then take what the input is or output is and basically convert that to be compatible with the actual microcontroller itself.
Yeah, so if you just think about turning on an LED, which from Arduino, writing a sketch is pretty simple. Mm-hmm. That API is, you know, like digital out equals one or something, you know.
Yeah.
I don't remember the details, but
it's been a while, huh?
Underneath, yeah, it has. But Arduino's originally written for
ATmega 328s, yep.
8-bit microcontrollers, kind of their own design instruction set. And then as it got more popular, it's like, well, can we use Arduino on all these different ones? So what we were using was a 32-bit ARM Cortex-M from Freescale, which is a completely different architecture, even though they both do the same things. So you have to set up, you know, how do you access the GPIO ports? Well, that's completely different. You know, how do you turn them on or turn them off? So you have to have all those layers underneath that talk to the hardware and then present the same API at the top level. So
it's a benefit for the users, right, of course, but then the people that are doing that port have to kind of do all the in-between, the glue code and all the making sure it tests properly and it behaves the same, basically.
Yeah, and for the most part, you can get the API to match up pretty easily once you do all the low-level work. But one of the good things about Arduino is all the libraries that are available that do, you know, different peripheral access, different devices, and you just, you know, download this library, plug it in, it works. Well, it depends on how those libraries are written. If a lot of them are, oh, well, this is how the ATmega works, so we're writing the driver to that. And sometimes those libraries don't work the same. So you have to, like, write a compatibility layer in between there to get those to work.
Yeah. Well, how did you learn all this stuff? What is your background?
So I originally started in aerospace doing SATCOM products. So, for large passenger jets. So, let's see, the first one I worked on was an Inmarsat system. So it's a geostationary, bent pipe design satellite system, which was originally for maritime, Inmarsat. So ships could, have super, you know, fast data rates of like, you know, 200 bits per second or, you know, something really right, cutting edge. Right, because
they
need to
basically say where they are in the waters between, you know, the China and the U.S. or something like that, right?
Yeah, the idea of, you know, getting Netflix was not even a thought at that time. It was just a, hey, here's my position data and 200 bits per second. Oh, sure, that'll work. So that got adapted then for airline usage. So you put this giant honking antenna on top of a 747, and you can make phone calls. That was back when you could make phone calls in airplanes too.
Oh yeah,
before people realized that was. Yeah, you remember this?
And only $12 a minute, right? It's such a good deal, you know.
Yeah. Now most of those, I don't think were those satellite. Those were plane to ground station.
Oh, they were like, oh, got it. Yeah.
But once you get out over the ocean, you have to use satellite. So that's kind of where that came in. Mm-hmm. And then I also worked on later an Inmar or Iridium based project, and I guess Iridium's claim to fame, despite being a really good book around the disaster that was the business case of Iridium.
That's the, but the technically it's is the book.
Yeah. Great. Well, great one to check out if you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was a good book.
They offered polar coverage. So if you think about great circle routes, you're going from, you know, Europe to North America or Australia or whatever. You're probably flying over the pole or close to it at some point, and the geostationary satellites have no coverage there. So you're kind of in this blackout area of no coverage. And so that was the kind of Iridium claim to fame there. So I worked on that and did kind of the same thing. So
that's great.
And but that was a great environment to kind of grow up in as far as a software developer.
Yeah. Because I mean, I'm sure there's tons of challenges there, right? Of just not speed. Well,
it's regulated.
Yeah.
Right. So the environment, but the development, it's regulated. So you have to document everything you're doing. This, you know, very much water flow process of, we have to write all the, this is what we're going to do before you even get started. You have to write pages and volumes of documentation. And then, we actually worked with a global team before, you know, now that's kind of common, but then we had testers in Russia, another development team in London, the guys in London kind of were the primary and we were kind of secondary in Arizona. And then, but our main interface was a terminal connection to a VAX running in London. So that's where I did all my, programming over that onto the VAX, and documentation in like a textual word processor program. But we had like a custom developed version control system. So all that kind of stuff of, you know, checking your code, prove that your test your code, prove that it works. Mm-hmm. That was kind of hammered into my head from an early start, especially if you check in code that breaks the build and you leave for the day, the guys in London come in the morning and they can't do anything. And then when you come in the next day, you get screamed at for a half an hour. So
yeah, I believe
you learn, oh, I better check it. I better test my code before I check it in. So
Do you find yourself, I have to imagine with a VAX and all that, all those constraints you just said, you're not entering the good old days very often. You're not, talking about that as much.
Well, I mean, even at the time, and this was what, about year 2000, at that time it was, archaic, right?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
And now it seems like a whole different, I feel like the guys that were there are saying, well, we used to do punch cards, which I couldn't even imagine how that would work to do, to do punch cards. So.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, so you and I ended up working together at Hologram, and that was great. And then we started consulting together as well for a project. And we probably can't talk too much about the details of that other than to say it was also cellular, and we enjoyed working on that together. But that was a cool project. And one thing that I've always appreciated about working with you is, well, I appreciate it after the fact, not in the moment. I'm always like, gosh, what? I forgot to talk to Eric. And so we're going to do that here. This is airing live. This is my dirty laundry. Maybe our joint dirty laundry here of I've been working on a design, and this follows the same pattern that we had in the past, where it would be get to a certain point and you should really check it with, a firmware friend or the person that's working on firmware with you, because boy, oh boy, it, not only is it good to always have a second set of eyes on it, but there's certain things that you see that I just, you know, I just don't think about. And this has been a repeated pattern. And so I was like, okay, well, we should catch this on camera of like me and Eric talking about this project that I've been, you know, designing the hardware for. And we've talked about working on together as a, you know, as a lead generation tool for our respective consulting businesses and stuff like that. And actually, I've been recording all of it for Contextual Electronics. So that's been interesting too. People that are watching this or listening to this can go and sign up for the course if they're interested. But I'm actually at the point where it lines up perfectly to talk about some of the things that that I should be checking into, right? So what are some of the things that you've caught before that I have completely gapped on? Maybe we should talk about that first.
Well, I mean, I've done a lot as far as, because mostly what I do is the embedded firmware, like we were talking about. I don't really do the hardware design, but I'll at least go through and double check designs, like layouts, make sure, you know, pins are connected, things make sense as part of my, I kind of learned that early on that if you just get handed, okay, here's what it is. Sometimes there, your life gets really difficult, right. Or we find out things like, oh, well, we can't actually do that feature the way it's wired up.
Yeah.
So one of the things is like just pin selection on a microcontroller. Some are very versatile, like the Nordic chips, for the most part, you can set any pin to any function, which is what makes your life, can make your life really easy. A lot of other ones have, like, if you want a UART or I2C, well, you got this pin or that pin, and that's it. Those are the only ones you can choose from. And so it's kind of a balancing act, because I could go through the data sheet and say, okay, here's all your pins. These are the ones we should use. And then you take that and you'd go to lay it out and realize, well, this pin's on this side of the board and this pin's on that side of the board. I have to use 12 vias and 8 layers to get to do this I2C bus. That's probably not going to work. So it's kind of, it's got to be a back and forth of, all right, well, here's some you can choose from. These are the things that are really important. This pin needs to be here. So let's work around that. And then other ones I'm flexible on.
Yeah. And I think the UART's a good example. So we had another example where there was 2 UARTs on board, and I was like, all right, I'll just choose one of them. And I didn't talk to you. And then it actually turned out that only one of them was capable of doing a bootloader. And so could you explain what a bootloader is for people that don't understand what that is?
Okay. So when you get a blank board with a microcontroller, it has no code on it, so it doesn't do anything. So for either the first time you load it, or you want to do in-field upgrades, you need to have a way for the chip to update itself. And a lot of them, and like the one we were talking about, have a piece of ROM in the chip that does a bootloader function, where it will take data from some kind of interface and then write that program to its own flash. That is really handy when you're doing in-field updates, which everybody wants to be able to do, especially, you know, new features, but also, you know, you hear about all the different security concerns all the time of, oh, this stack has a vulnerability, we got to patch this. So
you
don't want to lock yourself out of being able to update your product easily. Yeah.
Well, and even like to go back to the Arduino example before, right? A lot of Arduino boards are actually using a USB to serial, and it's actually programming it over the serial through the bootloader in that chip's ROM and doing the process like that. It's only when people brick it, then they realize, oh, there's some other way to program this board that I have to go and access then that I can't get through the serial bootloader.
Yeah. So a lot of times some chips will have a ROM program that will do that for you. A lot of them don't. And so that's a lot of what I've done over my consulting career is we need to be able to update this code. And so I basically will write a section of a code that is a bootloader, which will run. It's like a pre-program, kind of like, you know, same concept of a U-boot in Linux. So this runs first. It checks to see, all right, are we going to do an update? If not, it just goes, then it just transparently goes to the main application. Otherwise, it'll stay in there and look for, you know, the update program coming in, reprogram it, and reset. But the thing about microcontrollers is you can't write to the same place you're reading from, at least in Flash. The way Flash works is usually you have to erase a huge chunk of it to be able to write any of it. And so you have to have your microcontroller memory either segmented either by your design or by using a separate ROM bootloader. So that's kind of the challenge as far as, you know, you can't just hit an update button and reprogram itself.
Right. Right. If there is an update button, someone has put it there and it might have been you.
Yeah, all this is happening underneath the covers and you don't see it, and hopefully it works, and hopefully you don't turn off the power in the middle and it gets zapped. But
there
are ways around that too if you're careful. So.
Yep. Yeah, and so the pin assignment stuff is another one you mentioned, and that's been an interesting one where you know, certain functions internally, so you'd mentioned the NRF52. We'll actually be talking about that chip here because that's actually on this design that we're going to be talking about. But other ones where, you know, maybe it's not the wrong UART or whatever, but it's, hey, this pin has to be, you know, it might show that it's capable of being a reset and a chip select, but hey, we need the reset, so you can't use it as a chip select or something like that. You know, it's kind of they give you the either or, but you have to really kind of put a matrix together and say all of the different things that could be happening and then choose which functions you're actually using and then kind of pull those out. And like you said, prioritizing seems like that's kind of the best method that you've kind of come up with too.
Yeah, you really have to figure out, okay, what are my constraints as far as what do I care about? Like if I need analog inputs, usually a chip has multiple analog inputs to choose from. Like if it has a analog to digital converter peripheral in the chip, it has multiple pins you could choose from. So yes, you have some flexibility there, but not all the pins are analog capable, so you have to like kind of reserve those if you know you're going to have some analog functionality, you know, especially now. Or and then when you talk about, oh, we may want to add stuff later to this design and not have to rewrite all the firmware for a new board, well, you got to kind of figure out, all right, well, which things do I need to reserve, what things might we use in the future. So there's a lot of prioritization and optimization that you can do.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let's take a quick look at, so the way we're going to do this, because this is a video and maybe some people listening over audio, we're going to look at the schematic here. I'm going to share my screen and then I'm going to try and explain kind of what's going on as well as we go through it. And then we'll kind of talk through some of the considerations that Eric comes up with, and we might pull up data sheets and other fun things like that. It seems like data sheets are also another important thing to really dig into. What is your usual method when you're starting to look through a data sheet for a particular chip?
So yeah, the data sheet is really the first place you start when you're trying to figure out, all right, what do I need? So you have a list of kind of your needs. I know I need so many of this port, so many of that port, and that's where you start, and you think, okay, once you find a chip, you think, all right, this is going to meet what we need for this design. Then you start going through, all right, how is this laid out? Maybe it can do two I2C ports and it can do two SPI ports, but not four. You can only, you know, mix and match. How's that work? You know, how many analog inputs, how many digital inputs? So you just go back to that prioritization thing. And then a lot of times you focus on when choosing a chip.
Yeah, that's a great point too.
What's the underlying architecture, and what are you most familiar with? What are you most comfortable with? So, I've done most of my work with ARM Cortex M, and those have lots of different vendors. So there's lots of different parts available, whether it's from ST, Micro, TI, NXP. There's a lot of different vendors, so you got a lot of different choices for ARM, and there's a lot of different ones. But the core of the ARM processor is the same no matter who the vendors are, but they have their own peripherals. So there's something called a SysTick that's built into the ARM Cortex-M. So it's basically just a counter. So you could use it as like your system clock counter. Mm-hmm. but the UART peripheral on an STMicro, how the registers are laid out is completely different than like an NXP, even though they're both ARM Cortex M.
And so you're saying that so you feel comfortable being in this system, but then you have to go and figure out what the actions are going to be to customize it to the specific chipset. And like you said, the peripherals might be all different and talking to the different buses and things like that.
Yeah. So really, most of the vendors will have drivers that they'll release with their chips. They'll have a development environment where you don't have to write at the register level. So like for a UART in particular, we can talk about that. When you want to get a byte from the UART, there's a memory mapped register hardware address that means that you read that and that pulls the byte out of the UART. That's how you receive it. So let's say like STMicro or NXP, they'll have a driver that will kind of like the Arduino does, where you can call a function that will do that register read. And so you don't need to know like, okay, well, I need to look and see what's the actual value of that register. So it's kind of works at a higher layer. There are times though, when you want to, you know, sometimes those drivers are written to be able to cover all situations. And you want to, especially if you want to do something in like an interrupt, you need tight code and you want to know how many instructions are going to execute. You can always go down to that register level.
So it's about choosing like how much they're giving you, like how much the high level code they're giving you, how much you have to dig in, kind of like you said, it's like under the covers, under the hood of like, how much are you customizing it and really, really, you know, specializing for that chipset versus using this kind of high level code that allows you it's not really ever reuse it, but at least make it a little bit more readable or understandable or generic, like you said, to do different functions.
Right.
Okay, great. Well, let's take a look at this schematic that I have. So this is, that's me. There's a schematic. So this is the schematic that we have that I've been working on. And here's the, let me pull up the board, I suppose, as well. So this is the 3D model of it. It is a Raspberry Pi hat. So people that are not viewing it right now, it's basically the same shape as a Raspberry Pi hat. In the middle, there's a breakaway section that allows you to break away just the cellular and Bluetooth. So this has a NRF52 on it, which is a small black chip in the lower left corner here. The cellular module is either EG91 or BG95 from Quictel. And that allows you to either be Cat1 or Cat M1, and there will be links in the show to each of these and what those mean. I know that could be confusing if people are new here. And then there's USB-C to talk to the NRF52, and then a bunch of power handling and in order to do that, SIM card reader, SD card reader. This is some level translation here, and then an expansion header. And this is kind of the whole thing that basically it has these mounting posts here. So it has mounting posts that are kind of soldered into the board naturally. And then the whole thing kind of sandwiches together and allows you to make basically a little sandwich with the cellular Bluetooth section on the bottom. And then on the top piece of quote unquote bread, you can kind of design in whatever you want. And it has a flexible amount of IO that you can talk to it with. And so like I mentioned at the beginning, this is a board that I've been showing how to build on contextualelectronics.com. Eric and I have talked about, you know, working on this together on the firmware side as well. And this is, we kind of came up with the idea together. And then this is genericized enough that I can use this for basically any hardware project I need. I just need to go and make a different daughter card for it. And daughter card being like a, just a name for a generic board that plugs into this motherboard. So daughter card, motherboard, that kind of idea. And so, Eric, you have seen similar these parts before, NRF52. You've worked with the BG96 before, I believe.
Yeah.
So, so you had mentioned the flexibility NRF52. Any other thoughts about the chip itself, and things to kind of keep in mind for people that are not familiar with it?
So the NRF52 The kind of the main feature there is the Bluetooth integration. Yeah. And the nice thing about that is it's got a separate core that runs the Bluetooth functionality on that one. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah.
I think that's right.
So it's got they call them soft devices, I believe. So you basically, I think you just implement this code. You kind of like download the code. It's like a binary blob. At least that's the old way to do it. I think they have new ways that they're pulling in Zephyr and a bunch of weirdness. But the old way was like you put in like a, you have kind of like a preset software blob, and then you just kind of throw data into it and it puts data back out and it's all magic.
Yeah.
Right?
So when you work with those, when you work with those soft devices, though, that's their Bluetooth stack, mm-hmm. and you only get those in binary instead of the source because that's their secret sauce. And that, mm-hmm. but that's how they deliver it. And so you have to really kind of work within the constraints and rules of how that soft device works. Like so you're not able to work at the lowest level like you are most other microcontrollers if you're using that mm-hmm. soft device. So that's one of the things you really have to be kind of careful about is to follow like what they say as far as how do interrupts work. So a lot of times those are managed by the soft device and you kind of mm-hmm. get just told that there's been an interrupt you need to handle it. It kind of bubbles up. So it's kind of like a kernel running underneath and you're writing an application on top of that kernel as opposed to doing the entire system yourself on a bare metal system. So those kind of things, that's what a little bit different as far as those Nordic devices.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, so again, people coming in from maybe the Arduino world, you know, they're used to doing relatively low level stuff, right? Because they're just kind of, you know, peeking and poking registers and outputting and just handling things. You're basically saying now this is like having another micro on top of that micro, pretty much. That's kind of the idea, right? It's like nested Russian dolls of micros.
Yeah. They kind of give you an API of, to call instead of doing the direct hardware access.
Yeah.
So it's kind of managed for you.
Yeah.
Because they want to prioritize the radio functions and, you know, there's a lot of time constraints as far as, you know, when the transmit and receive actions need to happen. And so you're kind of second class on mm-hmm. at that point.
Right. But with the benefit being that you get Bluetooth, you get ANT or whatever, all the different things that they put on there. They have different radio types.
And,
you don't have to think about it.
It's managed for you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So if we look at the schematic, so this is, if people don't know this, so the schematic we're looking at here, this is all built in KiCad, as are all things in contextual electronics. And so basically I've hooked up a bunch of different signals here. At the top section, there's a bunch of power handling because the NRF52 actually has, I actually have the schematic up here. NRF52 has internal DC to DC and linear regulators. So basically it's meant to be, you know, a lot of what, NRF52 is used on a small Bluetooth nodes and things like that. So it needs to be able to handle just working off a coin cell battery or a small battery. And then there's some crystals. There's a programming header here. And then a bunch of flexible logic on the right side here. So this is another thing that I've gotten caught out before on chips where I thought we were using JTAG and it turned out it was actually SWD, which is single wire debug. That's been a problematic thing when we've worked together in the past too, right, Eric?
Yeah. So a lot of the lower end ARM chips to save cost. So like a lot of the Cortex M0 chips will mm-hmm. only support SWD, but then a lot of the like the M4s, M3s, M4s will support both JTAG and SWD. And really you can use either one of them if you have a debugger like a J-Link, it will do either one mm-hmm. easily. The SWD is a little simpler because it only has a clock and a data line, whereas JTAG is four lines.
I always figured that the it was somewhat is like a bandwidth thing that you only have two lines for SWD of a clock and a data, and with JTAG it's more like a SPI where you have data in both directions and that kind of thing. So you get a little bit more bandwidth for debugging.
Yeah, and I mean, I haven't really noticed the difference as far as when you use the one versus the other as far as debugging performance or ease of use. It's pretty seamless. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the lower end chips will only implement usually the SWD just to keep the the chip design. It's a little simpler and cost effective.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So if we look at this, so on the right side here, so again, this is a KiCad symbol. So what it's showing here is it's showing all of the various inputs and outputs and and so they're labeled P0 dot, and then the pin number. So it's P0.17 is port 0, pin 7, or well, port 0.17, I suppose. But there are two total ports, it's P0 and P1. One thing I was careful to do, so a lot of what this is, a lot of what I'm sending signals to is the expansion header, right, which is going to the daughter card. So this is just a 50-pin header that has a bunch of signals going up to the to a separate board, right? So it's a, again, it's a, that sandwich. If we, again, for people listening, it's going to be a little harder to see, but for people viewing, it's basically it's just a it's a 50-pin 0.05 mil pit or 0.05 inch pitch connector here, this black connector. And the whole thing plugs together, and basically the top board can then access all the signals on the bottom board. And so a lot of what I'm doing is I'm sending these signals there because these are flexible signals. What I've done here is I've actually assigned some of them to be SPI, but I've been careful to look at the data sheet and, well, for this time at least, I've been careful to look at the data sheet and see what's actually available there. So Eric, if I sent you a schematic like this, and I had just randomly assigned, you know, S-clock, MISO, and MOSI, how would you go and then check that on the data sheet?
Most microcontroller data sheets have a, most of them call it alternate function.
Okay.
So any digital I/O pin has, you know, GPIO functionality, and that's mm-hmm. usually kind of the default. You know, it's either input or output, high or low, pretty uh-huh. simple. But then there'll be a table of alternate functions for each pin. So say pin 0.019 there, maybe it could be a SPI clock, but it also could be a UART or I2C clock pin. Mm.
Yep.
But those are it's only two functions.
Yeah.
But the Nordic, like we were saying, is pretty nice where for the most part, you can assign those peripheral functions to any pin. Now, one of the big exceptions there is some of those are analog capable and some are not. So I would say using a Nordic like this, my first kind of constraint would be to identify any analog functionality I need, make sure that I use those pins you have to use, you know, analog pins for your analog functionality, but then try to reserve some of those if you have unused pins. So if you need to add analog functionality for something later, you still have those. Whereas the digital only pins, those analog pins can also do the digital functionality. But then you got to look at that table in the data sheet to make sure.
Yeah, that's a great point. And yeah, so these, so P0.02 through 05, those are all analog inputs. And then there's another set of analog inputs. There's a total of 8, 0.28. And like Eric said, I was able to make these generic. So I just kept the same pin name when I'm assigning it to the header. And so basically those 8 pins that are capable of being analog will all go up to the daughter card that is designed later. And so basically if we need to swap on, say pin 0.31, we could just say, hey, you're an analog input now, and it will route that signal internally to the ADC mm-hmm. and be able to handle that sort of thing. The signal that Eric was mentioning, P0.19, which was I had listed as S clock, which is part of the SPI peripheral. I usually just go and search through the data sheet here. This one actually is listed as a general purpose IO. It's not listed. There's some that are listed as standard drive, low frequency IO only. So I was careful not to use any of those for a SPI bus. And then there actually is a recommended usage column in the data sheet. And this one was the one that was QSPI or SClock. QSPI was something that is, I think that's like a higher speed version, right, Eric?
Yeah, it's the same as SPI, except you have extra data lines so you can get more bandwidth per each clock.
Right. So if you're doing like a high-speed transfer or something like that from a SPI memory or a SD card or something like that, you could basically get 4 bits of data instead of a single lane. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah, and a lot of times what's that used for is program execution in external flash.
So you
usually QSPI is fast enough to be able to do that and not significantly affect the performance of the chip, as opposed to just using your internal flash.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because that kind of goes back to the bootloader idea you had earlier. So instead of needing multiple sections in the flash, you could then just program the new program into QSPI, or into a spy flash rather, and then run out of there. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, especially if you had like a board optimized code or something like that. So you could program different algorithms for that specific board or series of boards in that QSPI, but have your common application in the internal flash. So if you had different variations of the same board, you could do it that way without having to have separate application builds.
That's cool. Yeah, that's a really cool idea. And then you could basically you could sell two or three or four SKUs of the same product without needing to build four different board types, right? You just flick a switch and hey, it's a brand new product. You put a new coat of paint on it and it's good to go.
Yeah, because you could obviously do multiple, have lots of if-def statements and do one code base for multiple hardware releases. But if you can keep it as simple, if you can, then it makes your life a lot easier going forward, especially with maintenance and adding features later and doing things like that. Yeah,
that's great. That's great. So let's see. Let's go back to the data sheet and schematic here. So other things that were on here, some of the top right corner here, it has the ability to do, GPIO or a secondary clock. And this is a 32.768 kilohertz crystal. What do you think of when you hear that magical number, Eric?
Oh yeah, that is a magic number. That's a real-time clock. So that's usually going to be used to generate a 1 second tick inside to keep track of your actual time. And a lot of times those have a separate battery power section. So that section of the chip can always be on and always be running. So you can power off the most of the chip, but you're still keeping track of time. Mm-hmm. So when you come back on, you don't need like a network connection to try to figure out, okay, what time is it? You already have that. So for battery conscious designs, that can be very beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's also like when you see a coin cell on a board, I always think like, oh, they've got a real time clock on there too. Cause that's just like, they just kind of pass it off to the coin cell and that thing will go as many years that coin cell is living, or sometimes they're even rechargeable. So it's a interesting setup for those kind of things. So if we look at the rest of the schematic. So like I said, the top section is power up here. We've got on the left side, we've got an antenna. So that's obviously Bluetooth. We already talked about the programming, which is a JTAG header going through Tag Connect. We've got a crystal, which is the main crystal. That's a 8 megahertz crystal, I believe. And then kind of everything else, I guess it has, USB-C connection, or well, it's really just D+D- using it as a USB 2.0. What is your experience with USB and using that as a bootloader and or, an interface and handling that sort of things with Cortex-M chips?
Well, it's pretty versatile, and it's pretty widely supported on a lot of different chips. So kind of the simplest thing you can use it for is a UART connection to a PC. Mm-hmm. So that's used quite a bit. A lot of times vendors will have a DFU profile, which is a device firmware update. So you can use the USB in conjunction with some kind of ROM code to be able to update a chip from your computer. So that's pretty convenient. You don't have to have special hardware that.
So you just like
you
press
and I
button.
Probably have.
Right.
But
it would just press
somebody
a button
else,
and go into that kind of mode or something like that.
Right. Or a lot of times, yeah, you'll hold down a button on when you plug it in. Mm-hmm. And that'll kick off this update mode.
Got it. That's great. Let's see. So I think that's kind of it here. So the other thing that is going between, so basically we haven't talked anything about the cellular. So obviously you have a lot of experience in cellular modems and things like that. So that's actually a different sheet that we're going to be looking at here. This is, so basically the BG95, EG91, they live in the 1.8 volt domain. And so we need to have a level translator, which basically allows 3.3 volt signals that the NRF52 is using to talk to the 1.8 volt signals. But then talking to the BG95 or EG91, that's all just talking over serial, right? Or over UART. So what does that usually entail to talk between a microcontroller and a external modem like that?
Yeah, the most common interface to a modem is still with a serial port and using something called AT commands. Back in the olden days when you actually had a dial-up modem, you know, you would type in ATDT and a phone number to talk to make a connection to another computer.
Wow.
And that kind of the same serial interface is still the main way you'd use a modem module like that with a microcontroller. They do offer USB interfaces now, but usually those are targeted more towards full-featured platforms like Linux or Windows, where they have drivers that run on the host machine to talk to the modem that way. But if you're using a microcontroller, you're usually going to send serial AT commands, which is on the surface seems simple, but as you dig into it, it can be quite complex because it's not really deterministic as far as it's not a simple state machine to handle sending and receiving the sending AT commands and all the possible responses and kind of spontaneous messages, asynchronous messages that the modem can send you. Say like you get a text message, right? You can at any time you could have this input stream pop up about alerting you to, you know, a text message or a change in your connection or something like that. So you need to be able to handle not just here's my command and here's the response I expect, but the modem could also be sending you other stuff too. And so your code has to be smart enough to be able to handle all that.
Right. And yeah, and handling with serial in the first place, it's like, it's human readable, which is really nice. But the downside being that like machines don't, you know, dealing with strings and C and dealing with, you know, these longer, you know, basically have to then go and capture and say, oh, it's AT plus something. And then there's some data value that's with it as well. It's just, it doesn't seem as succinct or as likely that a microcontroller would be communicating like that.
Yeah. So there are challenges as far as doing that. And just, you know, if you're writing something like that from scratch, just having a UART driver that will buffer all that data. So you don't miss bytes coming in
the
modem.
Right.
I mean, that's critical, right? Because if you missed one byte in the midst, there's no checksumming
there's no retries like TCP
with AT
or
commands.
Like yeah.
Yeah. It's AT plus something and then it ends in carriage return line feed. And so if you miss a line feed, you're in big trouble. Yeah. You're way out of sync with the modem. You basically have to start over. So that kind of stuff is critical. And then being able to parse and the format of what comes back from the modem, each command might do it a little bit differently. Uh-huh. So there's several different command response formats that it could send. So you have to be able to handle any of those depending on what command you're sending.
Got it. Yeah. 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 And I mean, so then when you're dealing with the actual modem itself, is it pretty self-contained? I mean, so we talked about the Bluetooth, it kind of runs on its own, does its own thing, and you just kind of send commands and get commands. Is it similar in that way that you are just kind of, you send something to the modem, it does its thing, and then maybe it gets a response back? Or how much interaction is there when you're talking between a micro and a modem like that?
So initially there's a lot of message exchange to set up the connection, make sure you have a signal, make sure check your connection state and get that modem configured in the right state for your whatever network you're going to be on. So there's usually a kind of boilerplate sequence of commands that you need to do to get it configured. And but that's going to vary a little bit from modem to modem, depending on the model and what it does in its specific command set. And the other thing it's kind of you have to look out for as far as what modem you're using, different vendors. So there's some common commands that pretty much all modems are going to support, but then there's vendor specific commands to be able to do features specific to that modem, and they use their own kind of command prefixing. So like a uBlox modem is going to have built-in command AT commands to do things like socket operations, or if it has GPS, GPS operations, and then a Quectel will have kind of similar commands, but formatted in their own way. And so you have to, so the more modems, if you want to support multiple modems, you have to be able to speak that modem's language.
Yeah. And dealing with individual modems as well, I was thinking there's other quirks about this as well, right? I was thinking the reset stuff, you know, like this is another thing that caught me out on a past one where like the reset, it actually requires like an inverter in front of it. And so, you know, you expect like, you know, when a reset N pin is like this, but it's like, oh, it's actually expecting a push button. So you have to emulate a push button by putting in an inverter and stuff like this.
Yeah, a lot of times the modems to power on, you'll need to do a pulse based on an output voltage that the modem itself generates. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be of at least a certain duration to get the modem from like a standby state to an active state. Right. And again, that's one of those things that's specific to each modem.
Yeah.
And the other, another thing I know that from the hardware perspective, the supply voltage mm-hmm. for a modem is usually not 3.3 or 5, which we're in the microcontroller world, we're very used to, but it's somewhere in between, like in the 3.8 to 4.2 kind of right. range.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been interesting looking at that more. That's actually tied to the fact that usually, you know, modems are usually meant for batteries, right? And batteries are usually lithium ion or similar, and they go from 4.2 volts down to 3.5. And so really that 3.8 volt number is kind of like the average, and it's really where the curve of lithium ion lives for like 80% of its lifespan. So that's kind of what it's based on. And so on this design, actually, we're actually not regulating the battery. It's assuming there's a battery on board, but then the specific part that is in here, this is the BQ25000 series. It actually can output a voltage regardless of whether a battery's in there as well. So it's got a switcher built into the battery charge management system, and this thing can actually output enough to charge the battery. But when the battery's not there, it'll still output to 3.3 volts, and it also can power crazy stuff. Like I could actually go and back power the Raspberry Pi, which is also kind of interesting. A downside of this, of course, is that you need to control it with an I2C bus, and it's got interrupts, and you know, basically there's like a tiny state machine that lives inside of the power management controller, which is not something you would normally expect, but then you have to set that up and have that ready to go. So yeah, lots of fun challenges there as well. So in terms of other characteristics that are things that you would normally check in a design, I mean, so we talked through some of the Bluetooth things and some of the, you know, obviously we have a lot of flexible logic here. So that's a nice thing. I mean, are there other kind of gotchas that you usually go and check for before?
Well, one thing specific to the modem, and then this can be kind of a general issue too, is the IO voltage of a modem is usually 1.8, at least mm-hmm. most of the ones I've seen are 1.8 volts.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not tolerant of anything much higher than 1.8 volts. So if you try to drive a input to the modem with a 3.3 volt output from a microcontroller, you may have a one-time
bad time
use modem there. Yeah. Not fun to do one-time use on modems. So
that's right. Yeah, they're not cheap either.
So that, And that's not, you know, specifically just to modems. Any peripheral you choose, you have to watch and make sure that your microcontroller voltage is going to be compatible with your peripheral voltages. And sometimes that your life is pretty easy. Like you'll have a, maybe you'll have a sensor that is, that will work anywhere from 3.3 to 1.8 just fine. So it doesn't matter. You hook it up and you're fine. Sometimes you'll have like maybe a sensor. I've had sensors where they need 5 volts to run and they have 5 volt IO and your microcontroller is 3.3 volts. Sometimes you'll find, you'll be able to find a microcontroller that has, that will run at 3.3 volts as its core voltage, but have its input pins be 5 volt tolerant. So you can, and usually that, that 3.3 volt output is enough to be a high voltage to your peripheral, even if it's at 5 volts, but if that 5 volts coming back won't damage your microcontroller. So that's pretty handy. Otherwise you need to do voltage level translators. And that is, you know, one more piece of complexity in your IO, and definitely a, something to consider as far as power usage.
Sure.
Because when you have those mismatches of voltages, I know we went, that was one of the problems we had trying to get lowest power usage on the dash, was that we had a voltage translator and the to the modem to be able to do the 3.3 to 1.8 volt conversion. And the way that it was originally laid out, when the modem turned off, that 1.8 volts was also turned off. But if the microcontroller was still running, the 3.3 volts was feeding into that voltage translator, and nothing on the other side, it was trying to match voltages to zero, and it was burning a lot of power doing nothing. So we had to end up using some enables and cutoffs to be able to make sure that that translator chip wasn't running when the modem was off.
Yeah, that's a great tip, actually. And I'm looking at the, so I'm looking at the level translator that I have here, the TXS0108, which is the recommended one from Quicktel. And yeah, I just have the output enable hooked to ground. So it's always on. So I should definitely send that as a signal to the actual micro so that it can go and actually turn that off, huh? Something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a few different ways you can design it, whether, you're using like switches that detect, if you have, voltage coming from one side or the other, or if you, it may be more appropriate for the microcontroller to have direct control. And that's only, only enable that voltage converter when you're ready to talk to the modem.
Yeah, that's great. I will definitely tie that in here. And yeah, this has been good. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm pretty excited to move this design forward. I mean, are there other general thoughts or other things you generally think about as you're moving designs forward? Other things you test, maybe in the bring up stage, things that have caught you up during bring up that would have been helpful in the hardware stage, like test points or similar things like that?
Yeah. If you go back to the schematic, one thing you always want to be clear about, and you're usually actually pretty good on this from designs I've seen from you, is anytime you have a bidirectional communication, like with a UART, if you just use a label like TX, you're asking for problems, because I don't know, there's probably a law named after someone for this, but it'll be wrong. It'll be backwards from what you think it is. So modems used to use like DTE and DCE terminology as far as who is TX and who's RX. And so you were talking about board bring up for the first time. And that's always a challenge, because you really never know what you're going to find. My usual process for doing development of a new design is, you don't want to wait until the hardware is completed and delivered before you start your software development, because that stretches the process out quite a bit. So my usual process is to find some sort of development kit that is either the same microcontroller or, you know, very similar. and kind of start the software design there to at least get the structure in place, figure out, you know, what drivers I need for what components. And you can really do maybe, depending on how many of your components you can get, as like maybe breakout boards or things you can just kind of fake in the interim, you can get maybe 80% of your software design done before the hardware is even delivered. And then you can focus on, all right, let's make sure this works on the target hardware and get those last few things working.
Right.
So if you start from that perspective, so you've already tested out a lot of your software before the hardware, because you're writing brand new code on brand new hardware, it's not always clear who made the mistake initially if you haven't proven out some of that firmware first. So I could be,
well, there's always lots of finger pointing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Why did you do this? Oh, yeah. Well, I actually didn't write that register correctly. That was software. Sorry about that.
Right.
Yeah. You should try to avoid that before you antagonize your hardware colleagues.
No, I think that's good.
Make sure
too,
it's not you first. Yeah.
Well, and then you have like a known good, right? You're just like, hey, it's not like, hey, I wrote this code, it should be working. It's like, no, I wrote this code and it is working right here. I can show you with the development board. Let's compare and contrast. And then that is super helpful for then the debugging process of the hardware and then finding out that, Chris hooked up the RxTx backwards or something like that.
It really is, but it's not foolproof. I had a situation where I had a dev kit board that used a similar but not the exact same microcontroller.
Oh.
And one of the IOs was that I was using, well, I'm trying to remember which way it was, but on one it was an analog and the other one it wasn't. Oh. And it was default in analog mode. And I hadn't changed it explicitly to digital mode because that pin was default digital mode. But once I went on the target board, I think that's what it was, that pin was default analog mode. So the digital functions didn't work.
Yeah.
And that's one of those where, you know, double check the data sheet. Especially if you're moving between similar but not exactly the same parts, make sure, what are the differences? What are the gotchas between these two parts?
Yeah, that's really good advice. Well, Eric, this has been really insightful, and I always appreciate working with you. I think I've learned so much from you just from our chats and our checks and just, you know, going back and forth and troubleshooting together. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Really the hardware software collaboration in embedded systems, I think it's really unique, because you to be a good firmware developer, you need to at least understand what the hardware is doing and what the needs of the hardware designer are and some of the constraints there. And I think it makes you a better hardware designer when you understand, this is what's important to a firmware developer that you wouldn't necessarily think about in a vacuum.
Yep.
It's good to have that back and forth interaction.
Yeah, definitely. Where can people find out more about you? And if they are looking for a firmware person, where can they go to hire you?
So I have been doing contract soft firmware development for more than 10 years now, but for the most part remotely. My consulting company is called Statropy Software, which in retrospect was a terrible name. And I know this because every time I go to the bank, I hear a different pronunciation of my company.
I'm trying to like freehand type your email, and I'm always like, Statropy?
I know.
No.
But I've stuck with it this long, so I'm
Yeah, exactly. It's unique. That's people will remember it eventually, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe. And it's statropy.com. And you can get a hold of me there. And you can see that I'm not a web designer. I'm a embedded software developer.
Yeah, that's right.
No confusion there. I've taken on all kinds of different embedded firmware projects on, lots of different industries, lots of different use cases. So that's really, I can do a lot of different programming, like a lot of different things, but this is really what I'm passionate about and love to do, just for there's just something different about it. The hardware interaction, you write code and It still excites me to write some code and then see an LED blink. That, hey, I still get a charge out of that. They're like, oh, you get definite tactile feedback on what.
Yeah, changing your environment is a powerful thing, I think.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us today, and I'm going to be reviewing this again with you soon, I'm sure.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
So that was our show with Eric, and it was really great to talk to him about his feedback about the schematic and really just to get his background on firmware and working in the industry, the stuff about punch cards, right? I mean, like, that's amazing that he had been working with people that were doing that. This is the third episode of the Contextual Electronics Podcast. We are really hoping that you will consider to go and give it an iTunes review. That really helps for people to go and find the show. And since we're a brand new podcast, we're obviously releasing all three episodes up front, but we are hoping to be found by more people. And so if you're willing to, please go give us a review. Honesty is the best policy. We don't care about what you write there, but please do let us know what you think. If you have other feedback that is not for an iTunes review and you just want to tell us, hey, I really like this, but I'd prefer to see this in the future, you can always send an email to podcast@contextualelectronics.com, or you can leave comments either on YouTube or in the blog post that goes along with this post. If you'd like to follow us in other places, my Twitter handle is Chris_Gamble, and Contextual Electronics has a Twitter handle as well. It's Contextual Electra. We ran out of characters, so we'll have the link for that in the show notes as well. And like I said, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love for you to share, and we'd love for you to come back. We already have a couple more episodes recorded, and we will be releasing them weekly, video and audio, and we're really excited about doing more stuff in the future. That's all for now. We'll see you in the next episode of the Contextual Electronics Podcast.